Well, thank you for joining me in this special edition of the Brian Sussman Show. Special because our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. Dr. Curry is the president and co-founder of the Climate Forecast Analysis Network. Prior to that, she chaired the Earth and Atmospheric Science Department at Georgia Tech for 13 years. She has been called a denier by those who are pushing the climate agenda. And it's amazing because when you meet her in just a moment, she is one of the most rational, down-to-earth, common sense people you will ever meet. But nonetheless, I digress. She has written a wonderful book that I highly recommend, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. It's thoughtful, it's thorough, and it is a wonderful example of truth-telling when it comes to climate science and the Earth's atmosphere. So with that introduction in mind, allow me to introduce you to Dr. Judith Curry, and away we go. Well, Dr. Curry, it is wonderful to see you. It's going to be great to talk to you. And I, of course, can't wait to ask you questions about your book. But first off, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. And thank you for inviting me for this conversation.
Can we get into your background? I know it's out there for people to read on their own, but I'm just curious, what got you into the field of science at large? I mean, here you are in high school, I'm guessing, and you decide to go to college to major in science, meteorology, atmospheric science. Talk to us about that.
Well, as a kid, I always liked geology. And in fifth grade, we had a geologist come visit our school. And I, you know, talked about, you know, the woolly mammoths and the ice ages, and I was hooked. Okay, so I, you know, geology was the thing. Growing up in Illinois, the geology was pretty boring, but you know, this is what I like. So when I went to college, you know, I was looking to major in earth science or something, but the course that hooked me was Introduction to Meteorology, because that combined math and physics with the earth science. I thought, this is what I want. And so, you know, I went from there, got my PhD at the University of Chicago, studying Arctic weather and climate. And I was in academia for my entire career until 2017, when I left for the private sector. So I've held faculty positions at a number of places, most recently at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where I served as chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years.
So now tell us what you're doing. You're based out of Nevada currently. Tell us about this part of your life.
Okay, well, back in 2006, myself and Peter Webster started a company, Climate Forecast Applications Network. And what we were looking to do was to apply cutting edge weather and climate research to actually helping people, mostly companies and government agencies, solve their problems. And so it was sort of, you know, low key for a decade while we were still at Georgia Tech. And once I resigned, you know, then I went with the company full time. And it's been a fascinating experience. It's really expanded my horizons in many different directions, many of which are, you know, are encompassed in my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Let's talk about the book. What was the impetus to write this book?
Maybe 2019, I was invited by Clivar Variations. It's one of the U.S. climate sort of big committees, you know, to write an article on climate uncertainty and risk. So I wrote this little article. I thought, wow, that would be a good, you know, a good title for a book. And so then COVID hit, and I got this email from Anthem Press saying, we're starting a new sustainability series. We'd like to invite you to write a book. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to be hunkered down for who knows how long with this COVID thing. Perfect time to write a book.
Right.
So I sent in a proposal for Climate Uncertainty and Risk, and I had no idea how it was going to be received. But they sent it out to a broad range of academic people to review, philosophers of science, economists, the whole works. And I got universally favorable reviews. And so they approved my proposal.
Was the publisher prepared for your position on climate
Oh,
change,
they
global
got it.
warming?
The publishers knew what they were getting into. And Anthem Press is a courageous publisher. It's a small but very reputable academic press. I mean, in the social sciences, they're a lot more open to this kind of disagreement, uncertainty, and all this kind of stuff than people in the climate community who are pushing, a dogma for all sorts of reasons that don't have a heck of a lot to do with actual science.
You've been able to watch this debate evolve over the years, as have I. At what point in time did you decide to take a stand one way or the other?
I got entrained into the public debate in 2005, and this was following Hurricane Katrina. Through a complete fluke, I co-authored a paper on global hurricane intensity that showed that the percent of category 4 and 5 hurricanes had increased substantially since 1970. So following Katrina, there was just an explosion of media interest in that. The message that we want to say, well, if you're going to rebuild New Orleans, you need to think about category 4 and 5 hurricanes. That was a message we wanted to get out, but everybody was talking about global warming. And so I got caught up in the global warming debate. And at the time, I made a decision that the responsible thing to do was, in my public statements about global warming, to support the IPCC consensus. Well, all that changed with the ClimateGate emails. This was in November of 2009, but this was a bunch of IPCC authors got their emails hacked, and this revealed all sorts of skullduggery from trying to evade Freedom of Information Act requests, sabotaging the peer review process, bypassing the IPCC rules and regulations about what papers could be included, and generally trying to sabotage anybody who disagreed with them, in some cases actually destroying their careers. I was reading all this and I was just appalled. And I said, I felt the need to speak up. I was concerned about, the integrity of climate research. I
Sure.
was worried about the reputation of the IPCC. But most importantly, I was worried about what are the students supposed to think about all this? I'm an educator and I can't just stand by and say nothing and let the students think that this is okay. So I wrote a series of essays that went viral, actually. And one of them was picked up by the New York Times. And I was basically saying, look, we need to make our data publicly available. We need to be transparent about our methods. We need to be honest about uncertainties. We need to avoid overconfidence in our conclusions. And finally, we need to be respectful of people, who disagree with us. Seems like motherhood and apple pie statements, but the climate establishment, viewed me as trying to destroy a manufactured consensus that I had built up over 20 years. And they saw me as a huge threat. Little old me is a huge threat. Just by saying we need to be honest. And so they didn't quite know what to do with me. But then after, a year or so of that, then they say, well, let's just call her a denier, throw her in the trash can with the cranks and the oil companies and whatever. Then whenever any time Judith Curry's name is mentioned, oh, she's a denier, a climate change denier. You don't need to pay attention to her. And so, it was very toxic, and I was sort of a lightning rod, even though I was saying, I think, deeply sensible
Yes.
things
Yes.
about the whole issue. And I said, and academia was just really getting toxic. And I said, okay, it's time to leave. I'll go do something else, which, and I retired right at the beginning of 2017 and went full time in the private sector, which was the best decision I could have made.
I've heard this same story, Judith, from other wonderful meteorologists and atmospheric scientists. That when this whole ClimateGate scandal broke out, they were able to see a side of their field of expertise that really sickened them. They were just appalled. But When did this whole idea of science being run by consensus come across your radar? Because that seems to be the way they're selling this nowadays.
There's an important distinction between a scientific consensus and consensus of scientists. You know, the Earth orbits the sun. I mean, nobody questions that, but nobody needs to talk about a consensus about that either. It's
Right.
a well-known scientific fact. A consensus of scientists is generally made of a group of scientists trying to seek power or at the request of politicians and policymakers. And the IPCC, very early on after the first assessment report, they were asked to seek consensus. Okay. And so if you carefully select the scientists that you want on the IPCC and then have this all further laundered by policymakers, you know, and then that's where you got a consensus. It's a manufactured consensus. It's not a true scientific consensus. It's a politically motivated, manufactured consensus of scientists. And there's just no reason for a consensus around climate change. It's deeply complex, deeply uncertain. There's a whole lot that we don't know and that we can't know. You don't say, oh, well, we need to get rid of all fossil fuel emissions by 2030 or 2050. I mean, that's the wrong approach. You know, it's where the cure is far worse than the disease. And the cure isn't really going to help the disease much anyway.
What the heck happened to the scientific method? It's as if we've thrown that out the window. So could you talk to me about that, please?
You know, it's okay. You have to look at the career incentives for a climate scientist. You know, if they go against the establishment, they'll end up like me, you know, ostracized. So they probably don't want to do that. They want to advance their career. You know, they want to toe the party line. And people who actually speak out vocally and become activists are seeing their careers rewarded, you know, with professional recognition, you know, from the professional societies, and they get helps their university attract big donor money to start climate institutes and all this kind of stuff. So all the career incentives are in that direction. And even with the journals like Science and Nature, you know, they have explicit policies in their editorials. I mean, they're not interested. You know, they have a narrative around climate change, and they are not, they don't even send papers out to review, you know, that are overtly questioning anything important in the narrative. So, you know, it's just the fix is in. You know, money and power, you know? recognition, you know, these are three motives that you would hope wouldn't dominate scientific research, but the system that we have right now, there you have it.
And it's a real sock in the gut to those of us who went into this with such a passion and appreciation for the field of study which we, endeavor to pursue. And in your particular case, I mean, you became, very well known in your field. And so to have to leave that, I mean, there had to be a certain sadness.
Oh no, not really. I mean, I looked at it, I just detached.
Okay.
Oh, it was so bad, so
It
toxic.
got that bad.
The whole climate situation got really bad following ClimateGate, say starting 2010, 2011. But universities in general really started to go down the tubes around 2015, you know, with all the DEI and cancel culture and all this kind of stuff. It just got really bad. You know, it was just time to leave. And, you know, and I understood that, you know, recognition from peers that I don't respect doesn't mean a heck of a lot. Okay. So, like, it's very easy to let it go. You know, and I'm having the work I'm doing for my clients and the company is just absolutely fascinating. We're deep into artificial intelligence and how we can improve weather forecasting, doing all sorts of cool applications. I'm talking with vineyards up in British Columbia who were clobbered by freezes the last 2 years. They want to know, oh my gosh, what's going on and what can we expect, you know, going forward. I mean, all these really fun, interesting problems that really spur a lot of challenging research. I mean, it's not like we're just turning the crank or processing climate models. We're doing fundamental research here to help address our clients' biggest weather and climate-related challenges. So it's just fascinating.
So with the lawsuit between Michael Mann and Mark Stein, I know you had some very thoughtful things to say following the result of that lawsuit. Could you please just explain to our audience your position on this and what you were trying to bring to the fore?
Okay, well, first and foremost, I mean, Michael Mann was suing these journalists. This is for something they wrote back in 2012, saying the fraudulent hockey stick, that kind of thing.
Right. His feelings were hurt.
Yeah, I mean, these are not climate scientists. Mark Stein's a political commentator, a satirist. Nobody in the climate world or even the mainstream media would pay attention to what they wrote, but he brought this lawsuit forward, I guess, trying to punish anybody who criticizes him. He can't take it. But at the same time, Michael Mann has poisoned, the public discourse on climate change by saying hateful things about, in particular, me. He views me as the biggest target. He seems to think I have an outsized influence, in the debate. And he is thought to, and he did destroy my academic career. Am I suing him? No, I don't want to just poison my life with this kind of hateful stuff. It is what it is, and you move on.
How much are you willing to talk about that? Because it is a
Oh, sure.
fascinating story, but I'm not sure
Okay.
that.
Oh, yeah, I talk about it. It's all in the transcript. His after the ClimateGate emails, he was trying to take me down. His first line of attack was Judith Curry is sleeping her way to the top, and she just parrots the opinions of whoever she's sleeping with. He was trying to make up something about who I was sleeping with and all this kind of stuff, and that didn't really take off, but he's out there saying that stuff. Okay, so then he took the different track, basically calling me a denier. I mean, back before ClimateGate, the word denier was thrown around to various politicians and journalists. Scientists were not calling denier, but Michael Mann decided to start calling me a denier and a few other scientists. And then this took off like wildfire with the journalists, who found people like me inconvenient. And so, every time the name Judith Curry, a well-known climate denier, Judith Curry, and the thing that really destroyed my career, it was 2013, I think. He wrote a Huffington Post op-ed about people who were scientists who were challenging, and he called me serial climate disinformer Judith Curry. Well, the Georgia Tech does a daily news feed. Every time anybody's mentioned in the news, they highlight it. And so very prominent, it goes to everybody, students, faculty members, staff, administrators, donors, alumni, everything. And then very prominently on this news feed, Judith Curry, serial climate disinformer. And at the time, I was under consideration for a position in the higher administration at Georgia Tech. I thought, game over, and I started reflecting on that. And I said, this is it. I've been, Georgia Tech has been poisoned for me. And I'm set, with a Google page like that, I'm essentially unhirable at any other university.
I think you took the high road for sure.
And so Michael, but the irony here is after this poisonous things that Michael Mann has done to me and other climate scientists, Roger Pilkey Jr., there are others, he's the one suing these political commentators for relatively mild statements that, in my opinion, are actually true. Okay, but his lawyer and Mark Stein, they had great lawyers and a brilliant case, and they were very good. But the venue was Washington, D.C. Once the jurors heard that Mark Stein had guest hosted for Rush Limbaugh and Tucker Carlson on Fox, it was game over. Game over. Mark Stein is guilty. And they gave, even though the actual damages were deemed to be $1, they gave, awarded $1 million punitive damages from Mark Stein. I mean, it's just because it's purely partisan. the day of reckoning for him will come at some point, but it can't be soon enough, as far as I'm concerned.
I hope you're correct on that. It was so damaging for the First Amendment at large. And I've seen some of his tweets. I mean, he blocked me from even viewing his Twitter feed a long time ago. But some of his tweets have actually stated that there's quote unquote empirical evidence that climate deniers are quote truly awful human beings. Well, that's just ridiculous.
I know he's
Talk to me about sustainable development. When did you first hear that term? I mean, it's a term that was concocted by the United Nations, but when did you first hear this term? And when you heard it, what did you think it meant?
you know, 2000-ish, I think I heard about this, and it was never easily defined. No, it's a sense of thing, a sense of things, trying to preserve resources for future use. It's a worldview that, doesn't like humans very much and views them as, a blight on the planet, than
Well said.
that and
Okay.
that the environment is fragile.
There's this rhetoric battle that also takes place, which makes it so difficult to cut through the noise when people are using terms like rain bombs and boiling oceans or even atmospheric rivers. I mean, I always thought we just called them stationary cold fronts, but now they're using these things as scary terms that are going to take out the world. Your thoughts on that?
Well, even the IPCC, if you read the fine print, they acknowledge that there's basically no evidence of worsening extreme weather events. I mean, other than heat waves, but cold waves are being reduced, and there's greater loss of life from cold waves than heat
Right.
waves, which they never mentioned. So all in all, in terms of extreme weather events, there's no case to be made that they're tied to global warming. But that doesn't stop the media and certain activist scientists from trying to blame every extreme weather event, on human caused fossil fueled warming. It's
Right.
just it's scientifically unjustified, but it's propaganda. It plays to people's fears. People pay attention to it. An extreme weather event is more salient than 1 degree temperature increase in the last 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't mean a heck of a lot. So they've picked up on the extremes, weather, as being effective propaganda.
I was looking at an interview with Dr. John Clauser, Nobel laureate 2022 in physics, and he was talking about the climate models. The first time he was able to look at the climate models, he came away appalled because there was so much estimation involving, for example, water vapor, cloud cover, etc. But talk to us about the climate models. What are their shortcomings, and are they being relied on too heavily by these climate scientists who are actually activists?
Well, climate models are useful tools for exploring how, for research, for exploring how the climate system works. You can poke it and whatever, but as pr predictive tools, they are totally not fit for purpose. They are not fit for purpose for separating out natural versus fossil fueled climate change, because they don't treat natural climate variability correctly. So, they're just not fit for purpose. Nevertheless, you've seen very heavy reliance on these climate models.
Are you amazed at how CO2 has been so vilified?
People who say, well, CO2 is only, a small fraction of a percent, whatever. Well, that ignores, the infrared radiation emission bands. Nitrogen is ubiquitous in the atmosphere, but it's not active in the infrared, so it doesn't matter. So, CO2 does matter in terms of, the Earth's radiation balance, but in terms of, a dominant player, in global weather and climate, I would say no. It's, CO2, the whole CO2 is a control knob thing. on time scales of decades to centuries. I mean, that's just not the case.
I saw one British tabloid, a headline that actually likened CO2. Well, they were calling CO2 a pollutant.
Oh,
That's how far we've gone, Dr.
I know.
Curry.
You
CO2
know,
is now a pollutant.
yeah, no, most of what the public hears or consumes on this issue is propaganda or carefully crafted spin.
It reminds me, I spoke at UC Berkeley probably like 2012, and it was in Lawrence Hall, their big their it was a political science class, but the professor brought me in to speak to about 200 or 300 students on climate change, global warming. And there was a point in time where the audience got a little raucous and they were starting to argue with me verbally, and he calmed everybody down. And after I shared for 45 minutes, I had probably 20 students who came forward, and they actually were angry because they had never heard my side of the debate before, as I just went through the climate record. They'd never heard that before. So I'm just asking you, as someone who spent so much time in academia, how do we change that? I mean, at the grade school level, at the junior high level, at the high school level, start teaching them the truth about atmospheric science, or is that impossible given the way our schools are run these days?
Oh, it's really bad in the schools. Kids are brainwashed from kindergarten on up, and they're taught more like climate impacts and policies and don't burn fossil fuels. They're not taught about weather or geology,
Right.
you
Right.
know, anything like that. Instead, they're taught all of this, what I would call climate studies, climate politics, and the indoctrinations, you know, starts at kindergarten.
Yeah.
Oh, you turn that around? I have absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea.
Your final chapter, I really enjoyed this. It was a great wrap-up for your book, but the section that really caught my eye was the apocalyptic climate politics. And I think this is a nice dovetail into that, because that's where we're at. We have all of these politicians that can be so bombastic with their rhetoric. They seem to be scientific illiterates, but they're able to so easily sell their positions to the masses. So talk to us about that, and what do you think the solution is at the end of the day?
You know, the solution at the end of the day, that's a tough one. The UN, you know, code red, highway to hell, all of these kind of things that they use. And the UN has actually backed off on the predictions before, you know, talking about, you know, 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by 2100. I mean, that
Oh,
is,
yeah.
I mean, it's totally unjustified, but now they're talking about, you know, maybe another 1 to 2 degrees warming by 2100, you know, which is much less scary, but that doesn't stop them from talking about the highway to hell and the urgent deadlines of
Right.
2030 and whatever. So, I mean, the climate catastrophe isn't what it used to be, you know, in terms of the numbers, but the UN keeps ramping up the rhetoric. And of course, the activists, scientists, and journalists and politicians, you know, echo it. But yeah, common sense has left the room. You know, what can I do? I can write a book. I can tweet. I have my blog, climate, et cetera, judithcurry.com. You know, I do what I can do, but you know, I'm just one little voice. But there's a large number of voices speaking, you know, out generally on the same message, but they don't have the mainstream media traction of a Michael Mann, for example.
Right.
So, I mean, if you look, I mean, you can find a lot of sensible people writing and talking about climate change, but they're not dominating the conversation at this point, unfortunately.
Dr. Curry, thank you for spending some time with us. This has been a wonderful interview, and I just appreciate you taking the time to write this book. As you know, writing a book is not an easy task, but I think you did a really fantastic job.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
If you enjoyed my interview with Dr. Judith Curry, please make sure you like, share, and subscribe. And by the way, don't forget her book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. Now, coming up at episode 237 of this podcast, I'm going to do something we just talked about with Dr. Curry. I'm going to review the temperature record. I think this will be very important, especially if you have a junior high schooler or a high schooler or even a college student who's not getting this in the classroom. This will be the proper, accurate history of the Earth's temperature. And then in the following episode, I'll do the same thing with carbon dioxide. What's too much? What's not enough? We will dive into those as well with some information that I have in my book, Climate Cult, as well as information I've shared in my past books, Eco-Tyranny and Climate Gate. In the meantime, my friends, thank you for your wonderful support and your prayers wherever you may be listening or watching. Please keep doing it. Thanks again, everyone. We'll see you next time.